walking very gingerly. Does that sound okay for everybody? I've decided it's dangerous to teach this Bible study. I mean, I already noticed that, like, a lot of times people are sick before they teach. Ann's been sick. Christina's been sick. And I know Terry's taught with jet lag. And Linda's office person just quit. She's teaching next week. But I thought, well, I'm never sick. I don't go on airplanes. And so, you know, I'm home safe. And it's dangerous to teach this Bible study. That's all I can say. Anyway, God was so with me. I mean, he was so with me. I had a Christian man there at that scene. And was so, I don't remember him. I did talk to him on the phone later. But anyway, and just in thinking about that, I thought, you know, well, I was get weepy, sorry. But I think the quality of teaching we've had has been so terrific and so wonderful. And Genesis is such a key foundational book. It's so important for us to really get a grip on this, to understand how God works in history, how God works in our lives, and what kind of God he is. And we see this so much through these stories that we have through Genesis. So I'm just going to give a brief overview kind of some of the highlights, you know, so far, starting with creation, how Jesus was there, because this is a book about Jesus. And then with Adam and Eve and the sin, and with the promise that her seed was going to bruise the head, meaning the death and the end of Satan, but that Jesus' heel would be bruised, you know, talking about the crucifixion, and with later his resurrection. And then years and years go by, and we don't even know how many, and we get to Abraham. And then chapter 12 is like a hugely important chapter, because that's where we start the family line of that Jesus came from. And in chapter 12, how God promised Abraham descendants and the land, and that through his seed, that's the one seed, that's Christ, that the whole earth, all the nations would be blessed. And problem is, Abraham doesn't have a lot of descendants. So this whole theme of barrenness with people that have like some significant child is just, it's all through the Bible, ending up with Elizabeth in the New Testament and John the Baptist. I mean, that was one of the interesting things I thought about in studying this lesson. But so Sarah doesn't even have a child till she's well past child bearing age, and then they get Isaac, and then of course Isaac and Rebecca have a fertility problem, but then they end up with two of the most dysfunctional set of twin people that we've seen yet. And but you know, I thought of this thing I heard from a lot of you probably have heard this, the Ray Steadman, he's dead now, but I've heard other people say this too, but he was the first one I ever heard say this, and that was how odd of God to choose the Jews. And it is so true, but it's so encouraging too, because he chooses all these dysfunctional people to do his will, and we are all dysfunctional people, and so he actually can do his will through us, and I find that really encouraging. And then also in studying this through this my section in particular, well, actually, just studying through my section, I have gained respect for Jacob than I ever had before. I've never liked him particularly. I just saw him as this manipulative, awful kind of person, and you know, I know Christina was just, I thought, so amazing that, you know, one of God's little coincidences that she had the passage where Abraham was told to sacrifice his only son, the son that he loved, Isaac. Excuse me. I thought, well, not quite in the same league, but I thought, you know, I've got chosen this passage here where Jacob comes up and is really a man of faith in this section that we have here. Hadn't ever recognized it really, just looked at him still as a manipulator, but he is a man of faith. And let's see. Okay, and also that he passed on his knowledge of God to his wives and children, because one of the things we notice in here, and Leah actually seems to be more of the spiritual one, but She uses the name of God, you know, that's translated in our Bible, like Lord with big caps, which is Yahweh or Jehovah, you know. And so she came from this pagan background, and yet she had come to know the Lord through her husband. And also, later we'll see, particularly in the life of Joseph, some really good theology. And I love, Anne pointed out a lot of the ironies last week in this whole thing with Jacob and Laban, here he and his mom had deceived Isaac, and then he gets to this family, and the father and the daughter deceive him. And then, you know, it's just the ironies in Scripture are just kind of amazing. But I think God uses these things, and I'll talk about that later. And then Jacob has this meeting with God at Bethel on his way. It's really not too far from home. It's nighttime. And here he'd had this cushy life, and he's laying down on the ground with a rock for a pillow. But God appears to him. And this is the first time God had appeared to him. And he repeated to him the promises that he'd repeated to Abraham and also to his father Isaac, that he was the one, that this land he was on was going to be his, he was going to have descendants, and that he's going to be with him. He was going to be with him and bless him. So he really shows us there's hope for everybody. Okay, now we're going to start with our first slide, start on a section here, which begins in I know I'm not talking too well because I can't take a deep breath, so please put up with that. Linda! Maybe I pushed the wrong, I bet I pushed the wrong thing. I think I pushed the black thing. Okay, there we go. Okay. Right. Okay, here we go. And it came to pass that when Rachel had borne Joseph, that Jacob said to Laban, "Send me away that I may go to my own place and to my own country. Give me my wives and my children, for whom I have served you a really long time, if you remember, and let me go, for you know my service which I have done for you." So with the birth of his son by his favorite wife, you know, he starts thinking about home and the promises of God, we can assume. And then Laban doesn't contradict anything he said as far as all this service that's going, but because he'd become a really good servant. You know, as Anne pointed that out last week, this was a new role for Jacob, being a servant. And he did it well. I mean, that was another thing that kind of surprised me as I examined this. And he's not even asking Laban for anything, just his wives and his children. I mean, he could have left with nothing, but God had other plans for him. And so, let's see, here we go, map. So I don't know if you can see where Haran is up there, like right around there. This is like modern day Syria. This is where he is with Laban. And so this is down here is where he wants to go. This is Bethel right here. Hopefully you can see the point. It's kind of to the left or to the west of the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea, which I'm sure you can probably see up there. So anyway, that's where he wants to go, trip of 300 miles. But the thing is, Laban knows a good thing when he sees it. And Laban said to him, "Please stay if I have found favor in your eyes, for I have learned by experience that the Lord has blessed me for your sake." And then he said, "Name me your wages and I will give it." I think that's interesting. I don't know if Jacob realized at the time, but he certainly did later, that he couldn't really trust Laban to give him anything he promised. But anyway, he does go along with this. And there are a bunch of things I want to point out here. Like one, the word experience that I have underlined there. Actually, it's in Hebrew, which I don't know Hebrew, but read people that did. It really means divination. And later in this passage, we come to where Laban has these gods. And in that culture, in this pagan culture, they consulted their little idols, their little gods, and that's how they found out things. And so his little gods told him, and here we have the word, we don't have it there. Where are we? Oh yeah, we do too. Okay, I thought I'd underlined it, but I hadn't. We have the Lord here too in caps. he recognized that it was Jacob's God that had done this. That's the Jehovah God, Yahweh. And yet he didn't embrace him. It's kind of interesting. Never does. Sees all this truth, but never embraces it. And then also, when God had made this promise to Jacob, you know, at Bethel, that he'd have the land and descendants, and that the promised seed of Messiah was going to come from him, I think that changed his life. I think that changed his whole viewpoint about God, about himself, because we see a definite change in his life from that moment on. And he learned how to work honestly and not be manipulative in his job. I think he'd seen that all this manipulation that he and his mom did and that he'd also done with his brother Esau, it just caused discontent, it caused resentment. It's not good family dynamics, actually. And then another thing, you know, that Ann pointed out last week, when he left, his mom said, "Well, I'll let you know when Esau's anger's cooled down and it's safe to come home." And you know, she never sent that message. Apparently, never thought it was safe to come home. She died before he was ever able to see his mom again. And I just think how sad, you know, for both of them. And even though God's will is being worked out and all this, you know, we suffer consequences when we go against God's will and don't do it his way. But I think Jacob really needed this lesson. He needed how to learn humility. He needed how to learn compassion for others. And we're going to see later in the story how he did learn to have compassion and consideration for Leah, even though she was never the favorite one, and even though he'd been deceived both by her father and by her. She went along with it. And so if you're going through a hard time, you know, right now, I think these are such good things to think about and meditate on, that God is working behind all of our circumstances. And when we know him, he is going to bless us, and he is going to turn things out for the good. And if we're not sure why things are going on, just it's always good to ask God to reveal that to you. I know the first time when I was in the teaching rotation, or not the first time, but when I was in the teaching rotation here, I shared that twice we had just come really that close to bankruptcy. And God taught me really important lessons through that. I mean, the first time, it was definitely a process. It didn't happen like in a split second. But I learned that my relationship with him was so much more important than a house or things. And then the second time, as we were involved with some people who turned out to be really not very trustworthy, and you know, one of the lessons to learn from that is don't get involved in that kind of people, with those kind of people. You know, even though, you know, I mean, these people supposedly were Christians, but we didn't do the due diligence kind of thing. Jim has this friend who was always teaching his kids the 5 P's. Proper preparation prevents poor performance. And we didn't do any of that. You know, we just jumped into this thing. Seemed like a good kind of romantic thing. One of them ended up going to jail as a result of this, and hopefully he was a believer, and hopefully that was the school that God had him in to turn his life around. I don't really know, but the striking thing to me about that was that God was taking care of us. My husband had sold a boat to a guy that was an insolvency attorney. So Jim said, "Well, let's go talk to him and, you know, see what he has to say." We were there less than half an hour in his office. He called up all the creditors and got the amount that we would have to pay down to a manageable amount. It was millions. I mean, it was just beyond anything we could have ever hoped to pay. And I said, "Jim has been a conscientious servant kind of salesman to this guy. He really liked us. He just straightened everything out." And, you know, just the timing of all those kinds of things. You know, we did suffer consequences because we hadn't done our due diligence, but then also God protected us. I couldn't help but think about Joseph through all this, what a faithful servant he was through just really horrible kinds of circumstances, whether he was at Potiphar's house, wrongly accused in jail, or in Pharaoh's house. He was always just a conscientious servant. I thought, oh my gosh, I see these same qualities in his father Jacob. I was unexpected. So Jacob learned humility and servanthood, and in God's school at Laban's house. So, you know, just so what are we learning? I thought, just one of the things I thought was this mirrored behavior. Ann pointed that out last week, that Laban had mirrored the kind of behavior that Jacob used to have. And I thought about my own mirrored behavior, that often things that bother me in somebody else, if I sit down and think about it, if, you know, there, you know, maybe something in my own life. There's that saying, if you've got one finger pointing out here, you've got three fingers pointing back at you. And then another one I love that's even shorter is, you spot it, you got it. So anyway, Jacob, you know, he had been learning from all these experiences. And he'd learned how to be a servant. He learned how to be humble. And which made me think about Jesus, how he did not come to be served. He came to serve us. And I hope I'm not overdoing the whole servant thing of this passage, but it just jumped out at me everywhere I looked. So our dysfunctional Jacob actually models good servanthood. And then also in here, I underlined this, well, I already mentioned that, the experience thing. So Jacob agrees to stay. And Laban said, you know, say what your wages will be. And Jacob comes up with this thing that it sounds like Laban might have wanted to come up with, and probably that's why I agreed with it. And that was that Jacob could have all the spackled, spotted, speckled, okay, and I think it's brown lambs or whatever. And in Bedouin herds today, most sheep and goats are solid color. They're not speckled and spotted. Laban readily agrees. Jacob takes out all the speckled and spotted, which would have been in the minority. And I don't know, it doesn't say, but maybe he thought, you know, he'd get to start out with those anyway. But Laban takes all the speckled and spotted and brown and hauls them off 3 days away and leaves Jacob with just plain colored sheep and goats. And so he didn't start off really well. And then there's this thing about the rods. That was the first thing I thought of when I saw this passage. Do I have to teach on this passage with the rods? What a genetic tool. I mean, it just does not make sense. Okay, one thing he did do, though, that was just good animal husbandry, anybody that had anything to do with sheep and goats or animals of any kind would know that you only let the stronger mate with the stronger, you take out the weaker. He did do that. Okay, that makes good sense. But the commentators I read were all over the place on this rod thing. Some said it was manipulative, but I thought it was interesting. John Calvin said that, he's a big authority, right? That maybe that God had told him that in this dream that we come to, you know, later on in this passage, that was just something he was doing by obedience. Well, anyway, we don't know, but I think we can safely say the rods really had nothing to do with it. Color of the sheep and the goats. So 6 years go by. So during this time, God has all these speckled and spotted and brown lambs appear here from sheep that were predominantly solid colors. I mean, this was recessive gene coming out in just huge amounts here. It's amazing. You know, because God is God's doing, and Jacob later acknowledges that. I mean, he gives God the credit for that in his conversation later with his wives. So, now we're going to start chapter 31. Okay, up till now, Laban had been really happy with Jacob because he'd become rich, you know, through Jacob. But now, all of a sudden, Jacob's herds are larger than Laban's herds, and Laban's sons, you know, are noticing this, and Jacob notices that their faces aren't quite as friendly towards him as they used to be. And, earlier we noticed that Laban was happy when God had blessed Jacob. Well, now his sons are not happy, and he's not happy that God has blessed Jacob because they're not benefiting from the results. And this is kind of something to think about in our own lives sometimes when we get flack from people about our faith. It's not to be unexpected. So Jacob is realizing that it's kind of scary there for him. And at that point in time, here we go, another new slide. Okay, at that point in time, God appears to Jacob again and tells him, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. He's repeating the promise of being with him that he told him way back at Bethel, back at what he's promised. And, you know, I love that God doesn't tell us just something once. Things that, like, that was so great. Marilee was talking about the most frequent thing in the Bible, or command, is to not be afraid. He tells us over and over again the things that we need to hear a lot. And so he's telling Jacob again that he's going to be with him. That's why we need to be in our Bibles, too, to remind ourselves of truth like this. He is for us, no matter what our circumstances look like. And then I like it that Jacob called Rachel and Leah together. He didn't just tell them, okay, this is what we're going to do. But he talked to them about it and told them what the angel of God had told him in this dream. And that God had been noticing him. And that God had been noticing what Laban, how Laban had been treating him. And Jacob, you know, says it was really God that had blessed him. He doesn't give the rods or anything like that credit. I loved Leslie's story last week about the buses and all the honking in India, where it said, please notice me. I just couldn't help but think about this verse here. God notices everything about us. You know, when we brush our hair and there's hair there in the brush, I mean, he knows about that. It's just, I mean, we have an amazing, loving God. He notices us and cares about us. There's not a moment, not a nanosecond, when God doesn't know everything that's going on with us. And it's just, again, one of the reasons why these stories, I think, are so valuable to us. And it's easy to forget that when things are rough, and I know it's rough for a lot of you, you know, or some of you anyway, right now, but just be aware that God is working for you through all these things. Okay, so then Rachel and Leah get into this discussion about their inheritance at this point. At that time, it was customary that at least around half of the bride's price, the 7 years that he worked for each of them, would be given to the daughters. Well, that didn't happen here. Laban, you know, kept it all, which had to be painful for them. I mean, if your father did something like that to you, I'm sure you'd be hurt. And I think you can hear some of the pain in their voices, in what they say here about their dad and what happened. Are we not considered strangers by him? That's their father. For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money for all these riches which God has taken from our father. See, now Jacob's got all the flocks, or most of the flocks, and our children. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it. So they are totally with Jacob to go with him, which I think is always important, that families are united and together in big decisions, whatever they do. And anyway, so they take off. And they take off without telling Laban. And in thinking about this, I don't know if God told him to take off without telling Laban, or if it was because he was afraid. But since I am somebody who hates confrontation, I thought that this would be something good to address. I know I'm not alone in this. Jacob was never too good at just directly addressing problems. And so when we ignore problems, I found out by experience, they don't go away. They either come up in another form, or worse than it was before, but they just don't seem to go away. So it's really good to address them. And I call this recycling problems. You know, God loves us just exactly the way we are, but he loves us way too much to leave us that way. I mean, he's going to be working on us till the day we die, till the day we see him and are conformed to his image and no longer have a sin nature. That's going to be so great. And I just want to bring up, if you have a problem at all with this, Hebrews 12 is just a great chapter to meditate on and think about. It's really helpful. And another thing that's too easy to do with problem is directly addressing the person that's the problem with you. It's so much easier to talk to somebody else and complain to somebody else about it. Gossip, it's really easy to do, I know that. And complain about how unfair life is, blah, blah, blah. And I'm not saying it's not good to never talk to other people about it. is really good. We know from our study in Proverbs, it's really good to seek wise counsel from wise people, but not just to blab and blab and blab to somebody about it and not actually do anything about it. Or another thing, and I've done this too, we can save up our resentments until finally we just blast somebody. This too is not helpful. It's much better to deal with things as they come along. And I so admire people that do this. And some wise advice that was once given to me, and I found that it's actually been so helpful, and that is when I have something that needs to be brought up, is to pray about it and ask God for an opportunity to speak to the other person. And I've just been amazed. God actually has answered that prayer for me many, many, many times. He does make opening. And sometimes I've written out what I have to say when it's something that's really scary for me and read it to somebody else and asked for input, because I don't want to say anything that has some kind of hidden agenda I'm not even aware of, or barbs in there attacking the other person. So those are my thoughts on that. So anyway, then it was 3 days later, Jacob realized he's gone, and that made me think about the three-day rule. When you're really upset about something, don't say anything for 3 days till you've had a chance to think it over. Anyway, so 3 days later, Laban realizes that Jacob has gone, and he takes off in hot pursuit. And on his way, okay, did I forget to show? Oh, yeah, I did show the map. Anyway, on the map, they started out in, you know, what's modern-day Syria. Can you put the map up again, Linda, or is that hard? Oh, I can just go backwards. Oh, isn't that cool? Okay. Okay, so they're up here at Haran. Okay, Jacob is now down here in Gilead. So, and which is a good place for, okay, let me just go back. Where was I? Oh, no, we're not there yet. Okay, but on his way down, you know, Laban gets this message from God not to harm Jacob. And then I just thought it was interesting. In Laban's just anger at Jacob, when he gets there, he accuses them of stealing his daughters, which he'd sold his daughters. I mean, they definitely were not his anymore. I just thought that was kind of amusing. Okay, well, I might as well put this slide up now. Yeah, I underline those things. I found that really amusing. But before we actually get to that, it's this whole thing about the idols that Rachel had taken. So Laban not only accuses Jacob of stealing his daughters, but also his idols. Of course, he doesn't know that Rachel had taken them. And Jacob makes the statement, well, whoever has the idols must die, you know, not knowing it's his first beloved wife. And it just shows God's protection again. And of course, Rachel, I mean, she's learned how to deceive from her father, I guess, anyway. So she's sitting on him and saying it's her period. And so anyway, Laban doesn't find him out. And he not only doesn't find him out where the idols are, but he doesn't see anything that Jacob has that belonged to Laban. Jacob took nothing. He's an honest person. He's not stealing things anymore. Okay. So then the scripture has this longest speech that Jacob has in the whole Bible, where he just vents all the stuff he must have been saving up for years and years and years. And I just kind of wanted to cheer him on. Some things I thought were important in there, he just gives the facts. He never calls Laban names. He doesn't call him a cheat or anything like that. It's actually a pretty respectful vent when you think about it. And I think that's something always for us to think about. If we have anything against somebody where they've done wrong to us and we really need to confront it, don't want to attack them personally. So, particularly if it's your husband, something. So that's not too good. Jacob really has rightful, righteous indignation, but he talks in a respectful way. But one thing that Jacob does leave out of his vent, which is so significant, And this is something I'd alluded to earlier about Leah. He mentions nothing about the whole thing with the deception with Leah, which think of how humiliating that would have been for her there if he had talked about that. So it just shows that he got compassion and consideration for her. And, you know, maybe he'd even grow to love her to some extent, certainly not like Rachel. And we know that Leah loved Jacob because after the birth of their first son, it says, "Now therefore my husband will love me." That's what Reuben means. And then with another son, not quite so hopefully, this is the third one, it says, "Now this time my husband will become attached to me." So she never stopped, you know, loving him. But like I say, this is a priceless reply here. I just thought it was, you know, so funny. Everything is like my daughters, my children, my flock, mine. He is like the quintessential example of the selfish, worldly, graspy, greedy man, an idolatrous. He's seeking after wealth and not God. And he had seen how God had blessed Jacob. He knew that it was Jacob's God that was causing all this. But he, you know, it doesn't matter how much truth people hear, if their heart is not changed, it's just, they're not going to change anything. He'd enjoyed all the blessings that God brought, but he rejected the God that was responsible for them. And Jacob had been trusting God to bless him. He hadn't been after wealth. He'd been conscientious and responsible. And I really had not, like I say, I had not been prepared to see these things about Jacob when I started these studies. It was just a real eye-opener for me. I've been focusing on all his glaring negatives, and there are plenty, and there's still more to come, you know, about him too. He's not perfect, but I think it's important when we look at people, I mean, to be realistic about them, certainly, but just maybe focus more on what good we can see and encourage them in the good that we can see there rather than like being critical of the stuff that we don't like so much. And love them the way Christ loves us. To the best of our ability, you know, and by his grace, we have a gracious God that he can enable us to do that. And then lastly, we have this covenant. Actually, it's a non-aggression pact, not to invade the other person's territory. And I put the whole thing down here because normally all you hear is this first part. May the Lord watch between you and me when we're absent one from another, which sounds kind of nice, but actually it's like it's will the Lord watch and do something horrible to you if you invade my territory, is what it's saying. And this was amusing to me. He says, if you afflict my daughters or you take other wives besides my daughters, this from a man who hadn't really cared about his daughters. I don't know why he picked on that. Maybe he thought it sounded kind of righteous. But anyway, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. So these are kind of the last words we hear from Laban, fortunately. But I just thought it was kind of interesting to know, you know, where the Mizpah, which is so often, frequently, you know, talked about as something or used as something nice. And it can be, but that's not the way it was meant in this passage. So anyway, just wrap up. Where am I? Am I late, early? What time is it? Linda says I'm okay. She's in charge. So, you know, I just have a few more things to say to wrap up here. And just to kind of emphasize some of the things that stuck out and grabbed me anyway, but the idea of servanthood, you know, once more, no matter what our circumstances, especially when they're not ideal. And, you know, like Ann pointed out last week, like Jacob had planned, worked for, and expected Rachel, and what he got was Leah. And so if we've worked hard and we get him to get a Leah, not what we expected, just to be accepted and be faithful in whatever God has before us. You know, what is before us? What does God want us to do now? And then also this thing about addressing problems in a timely manner. I thought if any of you have problems with that, that might be a great thing to discuss in your small groups. And then lastly, feel weepy again. We haven't sung this recently in church, but I love this little chorus. because it's taught that he notices us. It's that whole thing of God is always noticing us, the intimate love and concern that he has for each one of us. And so that's it. Thank you.